This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. There are fewer hungry people in the world today than there were 30 years ago. When George McGovern ran for president in 1972, 35% of the world's population was hungry. 34 years later, in 1996, that number had been cut by half, cut to 17%, and that was with an increase in global population. Yet hunger remains a huge problem. Almost 800 million people remain hungry. Malnutrition and related causes remain a giant killer. In the last half century, hunger has killed three times as many people as who perished in the wars of the entire 20th century. These statistics are cited in a new book by George McGovern. It's titled The Third Freedom, Ending Hunger in Our Time. George McGovern believes we can cut hunger in half again by the year 2015 and end it in another 15 years, in the year 2030. The former presidential candidate, U.S. Senator, and most recently ambassador to the U.N. Agencies on Food and Agriculture is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, I encourage your questions on hunger for George McGovern. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Ambassador McGovern, good afternoon. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Oh, it's so nice to hear your voice.
Thank you.
What's the significance of the title, first of all, The Third Freedom?
Franklin Roosevelt, President Franklin Roosevelt, in 1941, made a great State of the Union address. That was before we were involved in World War II, but not much before. We came in at the end of that year after Pearl Harbor. The four freedoms that President Roosevelt talked about, he said, ought to be our objectives, not only for ourselves, but for other people. First of all, freedom of expression, freedom of speech. Secondly, freedom to worship as we see fit. Thirdly, freedom from want. And fourth, freedom from fear. I took the third freedom as the title of my book because that includes the hunger problem in the world. The subtitle of the book, I suppose, describes what it's all about, which is to end hunger in our time.
Ending hunger within 30 years. Achievable, you say, if we have the political will. And the opening sentence in your book, hunger is a political condition. Why do you call hunger a political condition?
Well, because it's a result of poor political leadership, and it will be ended only with better political leadership. We know how to produce enough food to meet the needs of everybody on this planet right now, but there are a number of problems that we have to overcome. Some people around our earth don't have the money to buy food. Many of those are poor children. Or vulnerable young mothers, single parent families stretching around the world. And so we need better leadership in the developing countries. That's not true with all of them. Some of them have very fine leaders, but a sizable percentage of them don't. And that's one of the reasons they've been willing to live with unacceptable hunger in their countries without doing very much about it. So it's our job, working through the United Nations and other international agencies, to take on this problem of hunger and to help the world eradicate it. You know, there are a lot of problems around the world that I don't see easy answers to. It may be a long time before we get on top of them. Hunger is not one of those. We can end hunger within the time frame that I've outlined in this book.
The question always, what does it require from us? What would it cost?
Well, it would cost about $6 billion a year, more than what the world is now doing to end hunger. Under the UN traditions, our share of that would be about one-fourth. So we're talking about somewhere around $1.5 to $2 billion a year that we would have to increase in terms of what we're doing on the hunger and agricultural problems. That's a lot of money. It's about the cost of a B-2 bomber, as a matter of fact, or that destroyer that was sabotaged out in the Middle East a few weeks ago. But it's something we can well afford. A lot of that could be in the form of surplus agricultural produce that we could contribute to the battle against hunger. Could I just suggest another question that we need to raise when we ask how much does it cost?
I think I know what it is. What's the cost of not ending hunger?
That's right. What does it cost not to end hunger in the world? What does it cost this world to have 800 million of its citizens dragging through life, too listless to produce very much work, too listless to learn very well, too listless to be creative and constructive? The World Bank tried to put a figure on that. It'd be impossible for me to put a dollar figure on it, but bankers have a way of putting an estimate on things in dollar and cents, and their estimate is that it costs us $16 billion a year to have that many hungry people on our planet who are not able to contribute very much productive life. So, in other words, it's going to cost more than twice as much if we do nothing as it will to invest in an intelligent program to end hunger.
Hmm. What do you say to people who see those outside our borders as our competitors?
Well, I would say this. These little hungry children around the world aren't competing with anybody. Take, for example, the school-age kids in the developing countries, Asia, Africa, Latin America, parts of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. There are about 300 million school-age kids who are not now getting any food during the school day. They don't have anything like the American school lunch program that we take for granted. I would say to people who are skeptical about doing something to help the hungry, that's an irrelevant idea in terms of the children of the world particularly. And so I would begin by trying to develop through the United Nations a good, nutritious school lunch every day for every school kid in the world. There's no one thing that I'm recommending in this book that's more important than that. We ought to do it. And other countries ought to help us do it, and it's well within our reach.
And for those children who are remaining at home and not in school, your second recommendation is for a supplemental nutrition program for women, infants, and children.
Well, that's right. Now, that program in the United States we call the WIC program. W-I-C stands for Women, Infants, Children. It's a wonderful program here in the United States. I don't know one single member in the Congress of either party that is against that program. It's been so successful that I'm glad to have my name on it as a principal author of the legislation that created it. I was helped by the Republican leader of the Senate, Bob Dole, and by the late Senator Hubert Humphrey. We were the three major sponsors of it. But what it does in this country that I'd like to see go worldwide, it provides nutrition supplements for needy pregnant women and for nursing women, young mothers, and their infants through the age of five. Now, that program, giving nourishment to pregnant and nursing women, has prevented many cases of mentally retarded children, deformed children, crippled children that are born to mothers who don't have adequate nutrition during pregnancy and nursing. It's needed desperately worldwide. And we could establish a program like that through the United Nations for, at the most, 1.5 to 2 billion a year. And we ought to do that. That's the companion piece to school lunches.
Are you confident these models would succeed elsewhere in the world?
I think they'd be more difficult to administer and run in other parts of the world because developing countries don't have the experience in operating public assistance programs of that kind that we've had in this country. So it's going to take people from the outside to assist in setting up these programs and then monitoring them to make sure that they're properly run. That's where we draw on the services of the World Food Program and the private voluntary agencies that have been operating such programs all over the world for some time. These are experienced, trained, educated supervisors that would be available to help run the program. We have 80 field offices of that kind in 80 different developing countries, and those are the countries where we probably ought to begin our school feeding and WIC-type programs.
The next couple of recommendations, food reserves and a farmers' corps, not unlike the Peace Corps. Tell us about these two ideas.
Can I back up a couple of feet?
Sure.
To make another observation on the school lunch program, and then we'll get into the reserves and the farmers' corps. We have among the 300 million school-age kids in these developing countries, 130 million school-age kids who don't go to school. Most of those are girls because of the favoritism towards boys. But once you start a school lunch program, parents make sure that both the girls and the boys get to school. Why? Because it takes pressure off the meager family food budget if their kids can get a good nutritious meal every day in the middle of the day. It does something else. Whereas illiterate girls who have not been to school start getting married when they're 11, 12, 13 years of age, and then have an average of 6 children for each of these illiterate girls. The ones who go to school, once they're drawn into school by the school lunch program, they marry later in life. They have more knowledge and concern about their lives, and they have a broader horizon, more interest. They have an average of 2.9 children, a little less than half the birth rate of illiterate girls. That's good news to people who think that we need to reduce the birth rate, but who don't believe in abortion, which includes the new president, now my boss. I'm going to talk with him about this, that if you can pull youngsters into school with a school lunch program, you're going to get the girls as well as the boys, and you're going to cut the birth rate in half. So that may seem miraculous, but it's based on studies that have been done by the United Nations in 6 different developing countries. So that's a big advantage of a universal school lunch program.
Yeah.
Now for the food reserves.
Well, can we go back to your campaign for improving education of girls?
Yeah.
Because there's some points here that I think are important to make as well, and I think that as long as we're on the topic, we might as well talk
Absolutely.
About these. You know, it seems obvious that education for girls is a good thing to those of us in this country, and improving education for girls is a good thing. But when you stop to think about all the improvements are likely with better education for girls, it's pretty amazing when you stack them up. A lower mortality rate for women.
Yes.
Healthier babies.
Yes.
And
better mothers.
Better mothers.
Better spouses. Better homemakers. better professional workers if they decide to go that way.
And mothers who are better mothers for female children.
Exactly. An educated mother stimulates the minds and the curiosity of their children better than most illiterate women. This is not a criticism of illiterate women. They have my love and compassion. They've got awful tough lives, and they do the best they can. But education can liberate those young girls and women to live much more creative and productive lives and to be more useful citizens in their own countries. In many cases, they may become the leaders in the future. Some of them may rise to become the heads of state in their developing countries. You know, this is not the opinion only of philanthropists or humane-minded reformers. The recent Secretary of the Treasury of the United States, Lawrence Summers, is a tough-minded guy who, when he was a chief executive of the World Bank, he said, dollar for dollar, the best thing we can do overseas in the developing world is to educate the girls. That'll produce more benefits on a dollar and cents basis than anything else we can do with foreign aid. I believe that. Of course, I'm an old teacher, so I believe in education, but it's especially vital for these young girls and women in the third world, many of whom are faced with lives of illiteracy, if we don't find some way to get them into school. Mm. And by the way, the best magnet that anybody has yet been able to come up with to pull kids into school is a daily school lunch. What would you want most if you were living in Africa or Asia or Latin America in a country that was faced with widespread hunger? The thing that would be on your mind more than anything else is how to get enough to eat. And if you can get that by going to school and eating a good nutritious meal every day in the middle of the day, you're going to do it if you have any brains. And I think that that's what's happening wherever we've started these school lunch programs.
Well, if you don't have food, shelter, and safety taken care of, you're not much good for anything else.
That's certainly true. Now, the food reserves that I'm proposing is something we already have partially. We have some grain reserves scattered around the world, but not enough. Right now, even as we speak, India has been hit with a terrible earthquake. They say the fatalities may run up in excess of 20,000 or more, but tens of thousands of other people have lost their homes. That earthquake has torn up the countryside and disrupted communications, smashed the stores and the office buildings and government buildings. They need food right now. And thank God we have the World Food Program in Rome that is already there providing emergency food relief operations. But we need more of these food reserves stationed at strategic points around the world so that when a hurricane hits or an earthquake or a drought or a pestilence invasion or a war or whatever it is, we need to have food in the area that can be quickly distributed, and it'll head off many thousands of cases of starvation if we do that. Mm. So food reserves, yes, and they need to be constructed and monitored under the eye of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. Now, the Farmers Corps, as you said in asking the question, borrows from the Peace Corps. What I'm proposing is that retired farmers in the United States, in the Scandinavian countries, in Australia, in Japan, elsewhere, retired farmers and their spouses would be recruited for 3 months, 6 months, a year, whatever seems practical, to go abroad and live in these one of these developing countries to assist farmers on the job in doing a better piece of work in how they handle water, land, pesticides, fertilizers, and other things that go into the production of food. That would be good for our retired farmers in advanced countries to give them something useful and constructive to do, and it would be good for the developing countries.
And finally, biotechnology. This is an area that's been controversial, but you support this area of high-yield scientific agriculture. Although you say caution is required, how did you come to your position on biotechnology?
Well, I came to this view that if we use judgment and care, and as I said, a measure of caution in which of these genetically modified crops we're going to endorse and encourage others to accept, with those provisos, I think it would be a tragedy to shut off research, scientific research, and scientific breakthroughs in this area. If we do that, it's going to mean the death of millions of people who otherwise can be saved. Let me just give you one illustration of the kind of scientifically modified crops that I'm for, and that's the new golden rice. Golden rice is called golden because it's yellow in color, in contrast to traditional rice, which is white. The problem with the white rice is this. There are about 2.5 billion people on this planet, that's well more than a third, who live almost exclusively on rice. If they had other foods available to them, I wouldn't worry so much about their exclusive reliance on rice, but in many cases they don't. And habits are deeply ingrained. They eat rice morning, noon, and night. And the difficulty here is that millions of them are going blind because of vitamin A deficiencies in white rice. Others are suffering other illnesses and premature death because of deficiencies of iron and other important nutrients. Two great European scientists, one from the University of Freiburg in Germany, one from the University of Zurich in Switzerland, have gotten together the last 10 years, and they've done very careful research and experimentation on a new strain of rice that they produce with genetic modifications that has all the nutrients that a growing child needs. It has great success in that it meets the problem of blindness and other illnesses resulting from white rice. But beyond that, it's environmentally better than white rice. It consumes less water. It uses less land. It requires less fertilizer and less pesticides. So environmentally, it's a breakthrough. Now, no one can say what the byproducts, good and bad, might be 25, 50 years down the road. So we have to monitor crops of this kind, not just before they're approved for use, but even after they've gone into use. But I can tell you, as one deeply concerned about global hunger, that it'll be an awful lot easier to end it if we make use of scientific agriculture.
Mm. George McGovern, ambassador to the UN Agencies on Food and Agriculture, is our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. He believes we can cut hunger in half by the year 2015 and end world hunger in another 15 years in the year 2030. He writes about his ideas in The Third Freedom, Ending Hunger in Our Time. his new book published by Simon & Schuster. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome your questions this afternoon for George McGovern on hunger. 333-WILL in Champaign-Urbana, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-WILL. A listener waits for us on the toll-free line. Good afternoon. Hello?
Hello.
Hi there. You're on the air. Listener, are you there? Well, we'll try and get that listener back here in just a moment. We'll see what the problem is.
I used to live out in that area.
Well, let's talk about that. Your interest in food and hunger goes back to your childhood in the Depression in South Dakota. And this raises a big issue, the prosperity or lack of prosperity for farmers under your proposals. What challenges would lie ahead for our farmers, and would current farm policy need to change?
Yes, we need to provide efficiently for farmers' surplus production up to a certain level to be taken off the market by government purchase and used in intelligent programs to end hunger both in this country and abroad. The way matters now stand, farmers produce more than the market will absorb at a fair price. And it's a good thing they do, because in the event of emergency, it's nice to have some surplus reserves. But those have to be isolated from the market, or they're going to break the price of hardworking American farmers. And that's why I believe in some kind of government program. I would hold it to a minimum of intervention into the lives and operations of farmers, but at least something to deal with the surplus and to isolate that from the market so that farmers can get a decent return on the rest of their crops.
Now let's see if we can grab hold of that listener on the toll-free line. Are you there?
Hello.
Hi there.
Yeah, I certainly share the last sentiment you gave, and but I think it's pretty countervailing to the current freedom to farm idea. What I wanted to ask about was your opinion on, you quoted Larry Summers when he was working at the World Bank, but there was also a document that came out of his office at that time that was pretty draconian in the sense that it suggested that, you know, industrial processes that are polluting should go on in third world countries where life expectancy was short. Pretty ghastly stuff, actually. And I think that the rest of the people in the world, maybe not too much Americans, know about structural adjustment policies and the fact that the World Bank and IMF both, terms of the deals they cut, insist on cutbacks in the very kind of programs that you're suggesting would be helpful. I think I share the sentiment that people who have been protesting the World Bank and IMF policies, I know they've been talking about changing, but we haven't seen it really on the ground yet, in my opinion, and I can't hang on any longer, so I'll have to listen to you comment off the air. Thanks.
Well, I agree with everything you said. We've got to do better, much better than we are. We've been too strict and demanding in things that we have required of developing countries. We, for example, demand balanced budgets. We haven't had a balanced budget in this country until the last year or so, and we can't expect developing countries to meet standards of that kind. We insist that they operate entirely in a free market. Well, that's wonderful if you have everything working in an ideal way, but that's not true in most of these developing countries. There has to be some government involvement in the economy if it's to work properly. I was just in Russia. I spent a week out in Siberia. I'm glad that I grew up in South Dakota to get me hardened to that Siberian climate. But I found very discouraging conditions out there. And I think one of the problems centers on this. We forgot when we were celebrating the collapse of the Soviet system that a bad economy is better than no economy at all. And today there's no safety net in much of the former Soviet Union. They don't want to go back to the communist system, obviously, but they would like to have some kind of assurance that minimum standards of life are going to be sustained, even if that involves some government intervention in the economy. So I think the caller is quite right that the World Bank and the IMF and some of the unilateral lending agencies have probably applied draconian measures to these developing countries that aren't practical. That's not to say that the World Bank and the IMF haven't done a lot of good things, too. They have. They've achieved many worthwhile things.
You note in the book that your role in the Senate on the Committee on Agriculture, later the Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition and Forestry, and the Senate Select Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs was one of the top achievements of your tenure in Congress. And you're generous in your praise for Bob Dole and other Republicans who you served with. Is that kind of cooperation possible today?
I think it is, and I think it has to be. When you've got a Senate that's divided 50-50, if you're going to get anything done, you have to have bipartisan cooperation. Bob Dole and I struck on that formula back in the 1970s. I had already been a presidential contender and was defeated in 1972. He was not to become the nominee of his party until 96. But in the interim, the two of us teamed up for about 10 years in the Senate to put through one food assistance measure after another. Considerable expansion of the food stamp program, the school lunch program, the WIC program, Meals on Wheels, all of those programs that eliminated malnutrition on the part of millions of Americans. And I'm very pleased that Bob Dole has endorsed my idea of a universal school lunch program. He went in with me to see President Clinton on this, and we together got the first $300 million in farm surpluses to get the program started this school year.
The Bush administration, of course, is only days old. Any response from the new administration and or Republicans in Congress today?
Well, they asked me to stay on as ambassador in Rome to these food and agriculture organizations. They know what I stand for. They know I'm a Democrat and that I'll have some differences with them in some policy areas, but I give them a couple of points for reaching out to have a well-known Democrat stay on in the office that I now hold. The answer to your question is yes. There's considerable support in the Congress, both among Republicans and Democrats, for these child feeding initiatives, especially the school lunch, the WIC program. Those are popular in Congress, and many members of both parties think they ought to be extended overseas.
Let's talk with some more listeners. Our next listener waits for us on line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. I want to applaud Senator McGovern for his efforts all the way through his life. I think he's been a wonderful example. And I'm wondering, there are a couple of things. If we have so much trouble getting our own government to agree to this, how do you figure that we will get other governments to agree to this? And also, then what do you do about corruption within governments where they take different things, you know, they take the food and
sure.
Stack it on the docks and things like that. And lastly, is there anything that ordinary people can do to try to help it? I've been hungry for lunch at different times, and it's been extremely uncomfortable, and I can't imagine what it's like to be hungry all day long. It just seems just an absolutely untenable situation that people should have to be hungry. So I'm going to hang up, and I'll listen to you. Thanks.
Well, those are good questions. First, how do we get other countries to engage in these kind of programs if we have so much trouble with our own? I want to say that the United States government has responded pretty well on these ideas. I mentioned that President Bill Clinton gave us the first $300 million in farm produce to get the universal school lunch program going. That program's already started, reaching into some 38 countries in this current school year. We're going to make the same kind of an appeal to the Bush administration. My friend Bob Dole, the Republican nominee of 96, he and I went in to see President Clinton and the White House staff and others, and we were very pleased that we got approval to get the program started. Now it's my job in Rome to talk to my counterparts, the ambassadors and representatives from other countries, about speaking to their governments and joining with us in this effort. It won't be easy, but I'm convinced we can get it done. We're not going to get every country. We're not going to get every government participating in this, but we do the best we can, and I think we'll get a sizable number. As to what individuals can do, participating in this program with the World Food Program and the private voluntary agencies are a number of these private agencies that need money. So does the World Food Program need money. You can send a check, if you wish, directly to the World Food Program. Just address it to the United Nations World Food Program, Rome, Italy, and that money will be put to good use in the areas of the world where it's most needed. Or you can send it to the World Service arm of whatever church and synagogue you're attached to that are engaged in feeding hungry people. Now, as to how we avoid the corruption and the diversion of food from where it's intended, that's why we have to have trained, experienced supervisors in the field making sure that these programs are properly carried out. The World Food Program of the United Nations, which I had the high privilege of helping to launch back in 1962, they have trained field forces in 80 of the developing countries. And those people are ready to go in supervising the unloading of food from the ships, its transportation to where it's needed, and the administration of the various feeding programs. They've had experience in doing that. They know how to do it. So do the private voluntary agencies, and that's our guarantee against corruption.
I want to thank the listener for her questions this afternoon. What's our situation regarding hunger here in the U.S.?
We have an estimated 31 million Americans who are hungry. I don't mean that they're starving to death as people are in Africa and parts of South Asia, but there are people who run out of food stamps before the end of the month, maybe single-parent families with four or five or six children. They just run out of stamps before the month is over. Or they're low-income people who are working but don't receive enough income to feed their families. Now, there's two things that we can and should do to eliminate the hungry in America. Number one, we ought to expand the coverage of food stamps, at least a modest expansion of that program. The second thing we ought to do is to increase the minimum wage modestly. I'm not talking about a gigantic jump, but something that that employers and consumers can pay at a time when this country is prosperous. And those two steps alone, a modest increase in food stamps, a modest increase in the minimum wage, would end hunger in the United States.
And you believe that this is something we could do in the first term of George W. Bush?
That's what I'm hoping we can do. I intend the first time I get a chance to talk with him to say what I've just said to the radio audience here. And I think the American people would support that.
I wonder if more people would get behind a campaign to end world hunger if hunger at home was first resolved.
I think so. I wish I could say to the American people and say to people around the world that the United States is a hunger-free country. We should be there. We should achieve that, and we can do it so easily in this country. There's no real excuse for hunger in America, where we've got the best farmers in the world and the best distribution system, and where I think we have an essentially humane population. So, yes, it would be better if we could end hunger in the United States before we begin to preach the necessity of ending hunger around the world.
Mm. We have a fair number of farmers and agricultural interests in our audience, Ambassador. And I'm wondering if you've spoken with the leadership of farm groups about your proposals on hunger.
I haven't had an opportunity to do much of that. I'm going to Denver later this week to talk to the National Farmers Union about this concept. I want to do the same thing with the Farm Bureau and with the Grange and with other farm organizations, the cooperative groups. My time is limited on speaking in this country because my job is in Rome. But within those limits, I hope I'll have an opportunity to meet with all the major farm organizations here in this country.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's been my privilege.
George McGovern. Look for his book, The Third Freedom, Ending Hunger in Our Time. George McGovern is a former presidential candidate, former U.S. senator. Most recently, he is ambassador to the U.N. agencies on food and agriculture. He's been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. His book, The Third Freedom, just out from Simon & Schuster.